Okay, I want to bring out a few further points. I think it follows from the discussion we had right before the break pertaining to the need for technological progress to be present in order for output to continue to grow in proportion to the supply of capital goods. I think the implication of that is that technological progress, insofar as it's necessary to maintain the productivity of capital goods, technological progress is a source of capital accumulation. Anything that contributes to the productivity of capital goods, enabling capital goods, the same capital goods, to produce more than they otherwise would have, that is a factor promoting capital accumulation. So technological progress promotes capital accumulation. Why? Because it makes it possible to produce more capital goods. Now notice, at different points in the term, when I was emphasizing the need, since the midterm actually, when I was emphasizing the need to treat capital goods and the demand for capital goods as separate and distinct from consumers' goods and the demand for consumers' goods, what's wrong with assuming that when you buy the consumer's goods, you're buying the whole banana, and when you're producing the consumer's goods, you're producing everything? Well, this analysis shows why it's necessary to treat capital goods separately and distinctly. Now, how is this? Well, here we are. We get an increase in the supply of capital goods in year two. Why? Because we're devoting a larger proportion of our effort to producing capital goods. The relative demand goes from 50-50 to 60-40. Okay, now notice what makes possible further capital accumulation in the succeeding years? Pardon me?
Productivity?
Well, it's
proportion.
It's with constant proportions. But also, notice, when we get more capital goods in year two compared with year one, what does the larger supply of capital goods serve to make possible? Still more capital goods, not just consumers' goods. See, the idea that all the economy produces is consumers' goods, that stands in the way. You would never get to see that if we have more capital goods, we can also produce more capital goods. It's not true that capital goods produce simply consumers' goods. They produce capital goods as well as consumers' goods. And when you have an additional supply of capital goods based here in year two on a rise in the demand for capital goods relative to consumers' goods, well, that's more saving. But notice, once we have these additional capital goods, it is possible to get a continuing increase in capital goods, assuming, of course, we have technological progress. Now, I should point out that the conventional view that doesn't see the separate existence of capital goods, it has no awareness that capital goods are used to produce capital goods, and when we have more capital goods, that is the foundation for still more. The conventional view on how we get more capital goods is simply through saving. They recognize capital goods depend on saving. But if the only thing that capital goods were used for were to produce consumers' goods, well, then what would happen after we have some saving? We've got some more capital goods based on the saving, but if they're all devoted just to producing consumers' goods, what do we need to do to get a further increase in the supply of capital goods?
More saving.
We would need more saving. Now, if you look at this diagram and you look at the succession of years, after we get beyond year two, within year two, within year three, is there any greater saving in year three than in year two, or in year four than in year three?
Yes.
No.
I'm hearing no from a couple of people, and yes. Why do you think yes, Ms. Nikolova?
Well, there's more capital goods than here.
There's more capital goods, but is there more saving in terms of the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers?
It's 60%.
It stays at 60-40. The demand for capital goods is remaining at 600. Now, you see, what's implied here is that the effect of saving is different than in the conventional view. And let me give you an analogy from the world of physics. For many, many centuries, the notion in physics was that in order to maintain the motion of an object, you needed to apply repeated force. You can think in these terms. You might remember from your own childhood, or maybe you have children, you watch a little child push a toy car across the table. He gives the car a shove, it moves, and then it comes to a stop, right? And to maintain the motion of the toy car, what do you have to do?
Constant motion.
You have to keep on pushing it. You need repeated acts of force in order to maintain motion. The view is, one act of force has a limited effect on motion, then it dies out. You need repeated force. Well, that was the view in physics prior to the time of Newton. What was one of the major discoveries of Newton? Well, that relates to this. That in Newton's view, the effect of an application of force was not to move an object one time, but to set it in motion in perpetuity with the same velocity in the same direction. This is, I think it's called the law of inertia, if I'm not mistaken. That the application of force creates velocity, a constant velocity in a definite direction. And then what's the effect if you apply more force? If you give the thing a second push, it will accelerate. So in Newton's view, the relationship of force to motion is not force creates motion, but force creates acceleration. The application of force provides acceleration. And that, I think, applies here to the effect of saving. In year two, compared with the previous figure, figure 14.4, in figure 14.4, we had saving of 500, demand for capital goods of 500, demand for consumers' goods of 500. Now here, starting in year two and continuing thereafter, we've had a one-time increase in saving. Instead of saving being 500, it's now 600. But it's constant at 600. It's not increasing. What is the effect of that on capital accumulation? Is it one shot or inertial?
Inertial.
It's inertial, provided we have technological progress. Now, Newton's proposition applied to a vacuum. What makes the toy car stop and makes it appear that we need repeated force, that's the presence of friction. Newton assumed the existence of a vacuum without any friction. Well, our counterpart of the frictionless vacuum is the positive presence of technological progress. If we have technological progress together with a one-shot increase in saving, that brings about an acceleration of capital accumulation. It's gone from 0 to 20%. We're in a position to see a different relationship between saving and capital accumulation. We don't need saving as one-to-one. We don't need a fresh act of saving for each fresh act of capital accumulation. Each increase in the degree of saving has an inertial effect on capital accumulation. Suppose we went here from 60-40 to 70-30. Do we need to do that in order simply to have capital accumulation?
No.
We'll have continuing capital accumulation if we have the constant 60-40 ratio with technological progress. If we went to 70-30, we don't need that for capital accumulation. That would give us an acceleration of capital accumulation. So one of the things that comes out here is that the relationship of saving to capital accumulation is not one-to-one, but as force to acceleration. And also that technological progress is itself a source of capital accumulation. And the previous increase in the supply of capital goods is a source of capital, of further capital accumulation. In year two, we have an increase in the supply of capital goods based on saving. In year two, what's brought about the increase in capital goods from 1 to 1.2 is that there's saving. It's gone from 50-50, 500-500 to 600-400. But once we have those capital goods, then we then get a further increase on the foundation of those capital goods. And of course, we'll need technological progress. But notice the effect of the additional saving is inertial, and that at the same time, technological progress appears as a source of capital accumulation. Now, these things are generally not recognized. It's thought that typically the relation of saving to capital accumulation is 1-to-1, that to have more capital accumulation, we need more saving. And it's also thought that technological progress is not a source of capital accumulation, that what we need technological progress for is to provide uses for capital accumulated simply on a foundation of saving. It's thought saving accumulates capital goods, and we need technological progress to provide new additional investment opportunities for the capital goods. That's not true. We need technological progress to provide the capital goods. That's the actual contribution of technological progress. There was a question back here.
There was. This seems, in some respects, similar to the dynamics of compounding interest.
Yeah, there is a connection, a relationship, yeah.
And so just trying to understand the momentum, you use Newton's example there, trying to understand the relation.
Yeah.
Is it pretty much the same, the idea of compound interest? You don't need to increase the principal amount that you invest, but rather the same principal each time it grows, and therefore it compounds into exponential. Is it the same, or is it different?
Well, there's an exponential element, that's for sure. I hesitate to try to translate it into the terms of a principal. I don't see that application right off the top of my head. Maybe it's there, but I'm not seeing it at the moment. What I think we should be aware of is that the connection between saving and capital accumulation is as force to acceleration. That's in this context. Notice we have a special context here, and the context is we have a fixed given quantity of money, a fixed total volume of spending.
Right.
In what I call an economy with an invariable money, a money fixed in quantity, fixed in total spending for new products, in such an economy, the effect of saving is inertial. We don't need continuing additional saving to get more capital accumulation. That would result in an acceleration of capital accumulation. Okay. Now, anything that serves to increase production, anything that is positive for production, will also be positive for capital accumulation. Why? Because capital goods are ordinary products. You see, once we see that capital goods are real goods, that they're not contained in the consumer's goods, that they too are produced, and we recognize that, then we are in a position to realize that anything that serves to increase our ability to produce in general will be positive for our ability to produce capital goods too. Anything that affects production in general affects our ability to produce capital goods. So that applies to technological progress. It applies to economic inefficiency of the kind represented by socialism. If we do anything that enables us to produce more with the same labor and capital goods, that will promote capital accumulation. If it's true that free trade means the same labor and capital goods result in a larger supply of products, and I think that is demonstrably true, but if you grant that, then what's the effect of adopting free trade on the ability to accumulate capital? If it's true that free trade enables us to produce more with the same labor and capital goods, and if capital goods are a regular product of the economic system, as in these diagrams, then what would be the effect of free trade on capital accumulation?
Increase.
It would increase it. It would make for more capital accumulation. And if it's the case that economic freedom is positive for production, then the freer the economy, the greater the ability to have capital accumulation.
Right.
Now, we see the opposite extreme with our analysis of the Soviet Union and socialism, but we can see important examples here at home, too. I'm sure you've all driven past service stations with their tanks torn up.
Yeah.
And they have to replace those tanks with double barrel tanks. Based on the fear that there might be some leakage of gasoline into the ground. Now, I don't know how serious that problem is. I suspect it's substantially exaggerated. But let us consider the implications for capital accumulation. In order to have gasoline storage tanks of a kind that satisfy the environmentalists, you need a much bigger capital investment. It's more expensive to have those tanks than the ones the gas stations had left to their own devices. Now, when a service station puts in these newer environmentalist-inspired tanks, is it able to conduct any larger physical volume of business?
No.
No, it cannot. So what are we doing? What's implied to this extent about the amount of capital goods we're using relative to the product we're producing?
It's a reduction.
We're using more capital goods to get the same product, or looking at it the other way, we're getting less product for the same capital goods. So what's it doing to the productivity of capital goods? It's reducing it. Now, if you the same type of situation exists with dry cleaning establishments, they've had to redo much of their equipment to comply with environmental regulations. The same thing applies to establishments engaged in painting various things, metal smelters. This is a widespread phenomenon in our economy. Now, whatever verdict you might pass on the desirability and necessity of these measures, look for a moment at what is the effect on the productivity of capital goods and the ability to accumulate capital goods.
Negative.
It is negative. Now, they might say, okay, it's negative, I don't care, it's still worth it to do this. But how wide do you think is the perception of the negative effect on the ability to accumulate capital goods?
We mean how wide?
To what extent are people aware in considering these proposals that there is some negative effect on the ability to accumulate capital goods?
There's nothing.
I think there's hardly any awareness. It doesn't even come up. But it's something there. Now, this is sort of ironic. Because in close connection with environmentalism, we have the phenomenon of environmental impact statements. Before you can do anything of significance, you have to prepare an environmental impact statement. Now, I don't know what principles there are to prepare such a thing. I exhale my breath. What is the effect of that on the environment? God only knows. I know it dissipates quickly, but I'm putting a little more carbon dioxide in the air. Am I warming the globe? Or I don't know. I really don't care. But if I had to write a report, what is the environmental impact of my breathing, I wouldn't know where to start. But what's ironic is no one in the environmental movement seems very concerned about the economic impact of what they're doing. They think anything that is negatively affecting the environment by some arbitrary standard, well, that we have to correct, irrespective of the cost. And no one seems to be concerned with the economic impact of such measures, which are not only, I think it's fairly well recognized, there's a higher cost involved, but that's typically ignored. It's assumed, well, yeah, the higher cost, that'll come out of the profits of the fat cat corporations. Doesn't have any impact on anything else. But you should be aware that anytime there's anything that increases costs, it's not very long going to come out of profits. The rate of profit tends to be pretty much the same. Anything that serves to raise costs is going to raise prices. That's where its impact is felt. Or reduce wages. That's another outcome. But what we see here is that there can be a cumulative effect. It can stand in the way. If it's lowering the productivity of capital goods, it can bring about a lower rate of capital accumulation. Yes, Ms. Nikolova.
Yeah, but in a way, doesn't that stimulate the technological advancement?
How's that?
That you must produce something better technologically. So you have to dispose of your previous capitals and obtain new capitals, but at the same time, you do have some technological advancement.
Well, you have to come up with some kind of new technology, but if the new technology is, it's a new technology, I suppose, to have double-barrel tanks. But if the new technology requires proportionally more material, more labor, more expense, It's not aiding us in filling the tanks of more automobiles in the same time. It's not doing anything like that. It's a new technology that has a higher cost. Yes, Mr. Foster.
Along those same lines, I was thinking in terms of government-imposed minimum wage.
Yeah.
Doesn't that create an incentive for businesses to come up with technological innovations because they're trying to reduce their cost?
All right, now, that's an argument that is sometimes given that, in fact, there's a name for this. It's been given the name Ricardo effect. Ricardo effect, that a rise in wage rates will lead to some kind of stimulus toward the development of more advanced technologies to compensate. And I'm sure there are cases where this occurs, but this doesn't mean an advancement. It means you've mitigated some of the higher cost, but that doesn't mean that you're better off than you were before. You're not as badly off with just the minimum wage, but you're not better off. And the people who are unemployed by the minimum wage, they're not made any better off. Now, a couple of further examples. I want to widen this point a little bit beyond environmental legislation. What is the typical attitude of labor unions toward any kind of labor-saving improvements, more efficient work methods? They're almost always against it. What is the effect of that on how much output can be produced with the same labor and capital goods? It's less. What's the effect on the productivity of capital goods? That's less. What is the implication for capital accumulation? That's less. A last example. There are often situations where if different firms merged, they might achieve some substantial economies of scale. A relatively simple example would be, imagine we have two firms and they're both contemplating using a certain type of equipment. But if one of them does it alone, it won't utilize that equipment very substantially. It might utilize it only, say, 40%, which is not enough to make it worthwhile. But if the two could merge between them, they'd use it 80%, and then it would be worth doing. If we prohibit such a merger, what's the effect on the productivity of the capital goods that are involved in that a new type of equipment?
Reduced.
We're holding it down. We're saying, all right, if you want to use it, you have to use it only to 40% of capacity, because we're not going to allow you to merge and use it to 80% of capacity. And so that improvement may not come into being. That's something that is limiting the productivity of capital goods. Well, the wider principle that I'm trying to get at with such examples is that the productivity of capital goods really depends on the degree of economic freedom in the country. To have maximum output relative to the inputs of capital goods and labor, you need the freest possible economy, the most incentivized, the least regulated. Because anything that serves to raise the cost of doing business is something that is requiring more means of production to achieve the same results. Yes, Mr. Foster.
Not that, of course, I can't contradict anything you said.
Well, you can.
But, you know, just I'm thinking about what you're saying, and I look at the third world countries, and I'm ignorant to this, but I don't think there's too many rules and regulations as to doing business there. But there's still far inferior as far as, you know, business and technical innovations as we have here in developed countries.
Yeah.
But we have government-imposed regulations like minimum wage, and which goes again with what I was suggesting, that it provides an incentive for technological innovation.
Okay. You're looking at the undeveloped backward countries of the world, and from what you're saying,
it looks free.
Okay, you think your view is that they have economic freedom, and maybe more than we do.
Maybe.
Because they have very little law. Now, if you have a lawless society where there is no government to speak of, does that represent freedom? Do you think that if you were living in Afghanistan, would you think you'd have freedom in Afghanistan? No, I mean, you'd be surrounded by lunatic marauders. And in many, many parts of the world, the government might not be too formidable. But then you have all kinds of local warlords, bandits, thieves. Do you think you have any security of property in such places? Okay, I don't think so. I don't think you do. And to the extent that such countries have governments, in order to do business there, we have. See, they don't have economic freedom. They have either anarchy or arbitrary government or some combination of that. And in order to be able to do business in most of those places, you'd have to be taking in a good portion of the high government officials as major partners. And then they could feel free to change the rules on you. So you're not the thing that you need to be free of is the initiation of physical force by other people. And that, you see, when you have a government, if the government is effective, that can protect you from the initiation of force by other private citizens. And then the key thing is, are you safe from the initiation of force by the government? And so what you need is a government that's effective, but also limited to protecting you from the initiation of force. That is the kind of government that came into existence briefly, and by no means for everybody, in Great Britain and then the United States. We had a limited government that established freedom from private citizens, and you didn't have to worry about the government. Now, this did not apply to everyone. There was black slavery, and that was the leading contradiction. But if the same system had been extended to blacks, then we'd have had a fully free country.
You yes, made a statement Mr. Barton. That productivity of capital goods depends on
economic freedom.
Okay, thank you.
If you had a fully free economy with no income tax, then any improvement you make, you keep the whole profit. That would be a powerful incentive to greater efficiency. Any loss that you incur, you can't use to as an offset to other profits. The loss will be felt to its full extent, so you're motivated to avoid losses more powerfully. You don't pay taxes that subsidize other people's inefficiencies. And you would not be hampered by arbitrary government regulation. So in that environment, we would be able to achieve the greatest possible output per unit of labor and capital that we have, and we'd be saving and investing very heavily. We'd have a high relative production of capital goods with a maximum productivity of capital goods. We'd have the basic groundwork for the most rapid possible capital accumulation and rise in the standard of living. Yes, Mr. Whitesides.
All right. I got a question. They're commonly referred to as like the framers, the founders of the country.
Yeah.
You know, our United States of America was founded on like the principle of trying to get out of taxes, right? We rebelled against Great Britain and revolted and had a great revolution against, you know, overtaxation. And it seemed like they, you know, were like on the right path. Mm-hmm. Like, how have we fallen so far off the wagon?
How we've fallen so far?
Okay. Like, to believe now that, like, oh, yeah, taxes is a solution?
I would say the founding fathers were more solidly on the right path even than you've indicated. They identified the principle of individual rights. They held that government exists to secure the rights of the individual, and those rights are life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and they should have also put in property.
Thank you.
And then we lost it. We lost the initial basic vision. And I think the basic reason that we lost it was the tremendous influence that came to be exercised in the 19th century by Marxism. Marxism argued that all of these freedoms might be meaningful in an agricultural society comprised of a large number of independent farmers. There it would apply. But in the conditions of a modern industrial economy, it didn't apply because, according to the Marxists, the condition of the great mass of wage earners is indistinguishable from that of slaves. And most people bought into this. They have the idea. If you think back to what you were taught in economic history, it's certainly true. The standard of living in the early 19th century, the late 18th century, was horrendously low. Real wages were a pittance. Hours were terrible. Young children were working conditions were a nightmare. What was the alleged cause? why we're conditioned so bad in the generally accepted view of things.
Capitalists.
The greedy capitalists. There were no hindrances to the exercise of the capitalist greed. So what did those capitalists do when they had this economic freedom? They took advantage. They drove wage rates to the minimum subsistence level. They were gouging the consumers, producing unsafe goods, dangerous food, one thing and another. You name the evil, they were doing it. Okay, so the terrible conditions are blamed on laissez-faire capitalism. And then what is the explanation of how and why conditions improved later in the 19th century and through the 20th century?
Unions.
Labor unions and government intervention in general. The
government. Suppressing the capitalist.
Pardon me?
And suppressing the capitalist.
Suppressing the capitalist. The government allowed the labor unions to go ahead. It sanctioned them. And then the labor unions were able to bring about higher wages, better conditions, shorter hours. That's the prevailing story. And the government itself intervened. It legislated a shorter working day. And then later on, it had Social Security and Medicare and one thing and another. And the implication is that the evil comes from the unrestrained greed of the businessmen. The good comes from the benevolence of the politicians.
Oh, okay.
This is the story. And I consider this the greatest fairy tale ever told. Mr. Brown.
Because of the greedy capitalists and not having control of labor wages, everything, because of that, efficiencies became one of the more dominating.
What?
Because wouldn't efficiencies in machinery and labor become more dominating because of government almost in that way, because of setting wage rates?
No, you see.
I know what you're saying, because I agree with.
Okay. This idea that if you arbitrarily raise wage rates, that will favor technological progress, I think that's fallacious, because you're assuming raising wage rates in an isolated sector, but what about raising the wage rates of the people who are producing the machines? What is the effect of that on the use of machinery? It
makes them more expensive.
It makes them more expensive. So if we have a general rise in wage rates throughout the economy, I don't think there's anything there to favor machinery. Now, and in any case, if you can use machinery, the machinery is more efficient typically, or well, as a rule, why do you need to arbitrarily raise wage rates? Suppose whatever wage rates we have, if we can employ a smaller number of workers at those same wage rates, and they can produce much more because they're using machinery, why won't we do it? Okay, so we don't need this extra to stimulate machinery. And then it's ironic, the unions to this extent would be claiming, well, see, we've done a lot of good. We've raised wage rates and we've promoted machinery. Do the unions really want machinery?
No.
No, they're not the friends of machinery. They do everything they can to prevent its introduction. Now, if you want an alternative explanation of economic history, I think I provided in chapter 14. I forget just how much I ask you to read of that. But looking back, there's a simple explanation of why conditions were so horrendous early in the 19th century. What was the state of the productivity of labor at that time?
Very low.
It was minimal. Just think of all the things that are around us that we take for granted.
Oh, yeah.
Electric light, was that there?
No.
Was electricity at all, or any electrical appliances? Automobiles, telephones, air conditioning, antibiotics, x-rays, elevators, any of the modern methods of production. It was all non-existent. And whatever was able to be produced took a tremendous amount of labor. Now, if you produce very, very little per hour of labor, but you have certain minimum essential requirements to live, what do you have to do to offset the very low output per hour of labor? Work long hours, and even have your children work. The reason for the long hours and child labor was not the greed of the capitalists, but the very primitive state of the productivity of labor based on a primitive state of technology and capital equipment. And what improved things was precisely the actions of the hated, greedy capitalist pigs, Because what did they do to make premium profits?
Improve what they're producing.
Yeah, they started introducing new products and more efficient methods of production. That's the way you make a premium profit. That's what they did. And as they did it, what happened to the productivity of labor and the whole variety of products available? It went up. That's why the standard of living went up. That's why real wages rose. And then as real wages rise, people don't need to work as much any longer to stay alive. You might imagine in 1780, you'd need to work 80 hours a week to barely live. But by 1820, if you're continuing to work 80 hours, now you're at twice the level of barely living. And in that environment, people can start thinking of working 70 hours instead of 80. They'll be still much better off, but less than twice as well off. But then by 1845, conditions have improved further, and now maybe people can start thinking of working 60 hours instead of 70. And how does this work? Well, suppose you get a growing number of workers who prefer one type of job or one set of conditions to another. But what do you think is the effect? If you have a job in a nice, cushy, air-conditioned office, how do you think the wage rates in such a job will compare to having to work out in horrendous, dangerous, very unpleasant conditions? They'd be lower, right? Because anything that represents a softer, cushier arrangement will have a discount in pay. If it's harder, more dangerous, obnoxious, there'll be a premium. Well, what happens, do you think, if large numbers of workers start to develop a preference for shorter hours? What will happen to the wages of the shorter hour week compared to the longer hour week that they don't want? The shorter hour week will go down, the long hour week will be more expensive. What then does it become economical for employers to start offering? The shorter week. This is how a free market operates, to shorten the week. If the government steps in advance of the free market, if it decrees a shorter work week before the conditions are right for it, like if our government today were to decree a 30-hour week, do you think we would benefit from that? Do you think we'd say, oh, well, now we all work 30 hours a week, that's really great, and everything else is the same? Mm-hmm. Do you think something else would be different?
Yeah.
Well, we would end up with substantially less real income. And we would, even if the union succeeded in maintaining, in getting increases in hourly wages equal to the shorter week. Because even if they did that, let's imagine we had a 30-hour week instead of a 40-hour week. And the unions required that hourly pay increase in the ratio of 4-3. So we'd make the same for 30 hours that we used to make for 40 hours. Okay, let's assume that. Well, even so, if we work 30 hours instead of 40 hours, what should we expect to happen to output? It should go down. And is it unreasonable to assume that output might be 3/4? Well, if it is, and we are spending the same amount of money to buy the output, but there's only 3/4, what's implied about the prices? There would be 4/3. 4/3, actually 33%. Well, here you are, you're earning the same pay for 30 hours as 40 hours, but you have to pay 4/3 the prices. So where are you? You're 3/4 what you used to be in real terms. See, big shock. You work 3/4, and even though you might earn the same money, you end up with 3/4 the standard of living. Would that be a measure in favor of the masses?
No.
No, but don't be surprised if someday we have politicians campaigning on it, because their view would be it comes out of the capitalist profits.
They're already doing that, though, aren't they?
Well, like, yeah, they are. I shouldn't say don't be surprised. Pretty much, I mean, we had a ballot proposition, which fortunately was defeated, and that is all of the medium and large employers would have to provide health insurance for their employees.
Yeah.
And the attitude was, oh, that just comes out of profits, and the employees will be the happy little people, and they'll now have insurance.
Unfortunately, it was defeated, or fortunately?
Fortunately, it was defeated. Fortunately.
Fortunately.
Yeah. I hope I didn't say unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay.
Did I say unfortunately?
I thought you said unfortunately.
We knew better than that.
Okay, I misspoke.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's equivalent to raising the minimum wage.
Yeah.
That would just cause a lot of unemployment. Okay, let's go on to some further aspects. I need the supplement. You guys ask so many good questions. I cover much less than I normally do, but it's better this way. We can develop the framework we've been looking at. I want to take it a step further. We have figure 15.5 and 15.6. This is simply an elaboration on the figures we've already been looking at and have spent a lot of time on. And the elaboration is in two respects. Before, all we had before was 1K of capital goods in response to 500 of demand for capital goods. 1C of consumers goods in response to 500 of demand for consumers goods. That's all we had in our simpler figures. And now we're adding some elaboration. The elaboration with respect to consumers goods is simpler, so look at that first. This 500 of demand for consumers goods is simultaneously 500 of sales revenues to the sellers of consumers goods. Any problem with that? I mean, that's pretty obvious. So we're just realizing that there's not only 500 of demand for consumers goods, but that 500 is also sales revenues to the sellers. Now, when we look over at the demand for capital goods, we see that this 500 of demand for capital goods is simultaneously also 500 of sales revenues to the sellers of the capital goods. So we can see that we have 1,000 of sales revenues in this economy. And also, this 500 of demand for capital goods will result in 500 of cost on account of capital goods to the buyers next year, the buyers of the capital goods, when they sell the products the capital goods are used to produce. So here we are in year two, 500 is being expended to buy this 1K of capital goods. And this will serve in production over here. And I put in now, we have 1K of capital goods at a cost of 500 to their buyers. Okay, so now we really know two things when we get to year three. When we get to year three, what is total business sales revenues?
1.5.
How much is taken in sales revenues between capital goods and consumers goods? It tells you right here. 1,000. 500 for consumers goods, 500 for capital goods. But what is the cost of...
500.
Yes?
500.
Okay, very good. That's right. You didn't complete the question.
Sure.
These 1K of capital goods that are used up to produce this output, they cost 500. So that's the cost of this output. We have the cost of producing the goods that bring in the sales revenue of 1,000 in year three, their cost is 500. That's the cost on account of capital goods. It's not their total cost, it's their cost on account of the capital goods. Are we missing any important element of cost?
Are there wages in there?
No, we don't have wages. We haven't shown wages. All we're doing is showing sales revenue and cost on account of capital goods. Yes?
When you talk about cost on account of capital goods, generally speaking, about the raw materials?
Well, here, all the capital goods would pretty much have that status because they're all used up in one fell swoop. We're not showing depreciation because we're assuming that all the capital goods are used up in 1 year. So even if something is a machine, it would be fully written off in that year. Yes,
I can't get past year two on this. I'm a little confused on it. We'll also add in 500 to cost on account of capital goods to the buyers next year. I can't grasp that for some reason. Can you
okay, all right.
Explain?
Here we are. In year two, let's say in year two, General Motors is part of this, and General Motors is spending five to buy steel sheet or whatever.
Okay.
Okay, that's going on in year two. And General Motors will sell its product in year three. Now, okay. The five that it spends in year two to produce the product that it sells in year three, that five is going to be a cost.
Okay. All right, okay.
And that applies through the whole economy.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So we have sales revenues in year three. The sales revenues are 1,000. And the costs on account of the capital goods are 500. And we're assuming that the costs on account of capital goods are uniform, evenly divided between the capital goods and consumers' goods produced. We're saying 1K of capital goods at a cost value of 250 on account of the capital goods used to produce them. In the previous period, we spent 500. Now these are the products available for sale in year three. Their cost value, as far as the capital goods goes, is 250. And similarly for the consumer's goods. 500 is expended for K. Half of K is used to produce capital goods, half to produce consumer's goods. So we allocate the 500 50-50. We have not shown wages. We'll get to that in the next round of diagrams. But can anyone make an inference as to the height of profits and wages taken together in year three? That we have sales revenues of 1,000. Now we know the cost on account of capital goods to bring in those sales revenues is 500. Can anyone make an inference as to the sum of the profits and wages together?
500.
That's also 500. Now why is that?
Revenue minus cost.
Well, revenue minus cost is profit, right?
Right.
Revenue minus cost is profit. What cost have we left out, though?
Wages.
Now, what is revenue minus cost minus wages? See, that's the one thing we're not counting. We have cost minus wages. Cost on account of capital goods. Cost on account of capital goods is the full cost minus the wages. We're not counting the wages yet. So if we subtract from sales, not costs, which would give us profit, but if instead we subtract costs exclusive of wages, costs minus the wages, what is sales minus costs minus wages? Think of it this way. Sales minus, parenthesis, costs minus wages, close parenthesis. Just carry out the subtraction step by step. What's sales minus costs?
Net income.
Or profit.
Yeah, profit.
Sales minus cost is profit. What is minus minus wages?
Still profit.
What is minus minus wages?
Plus wages.
Plus wages.
Plus wages.
So sales minus cost only on account of capital goods, sales minus cost minus wages, that's profit plus wages. And profit plus wages is national income. So by implication, we have an implied value of national income. A national income would be 500. If you have sales of 1,000 in an economy and costs on account of capital goods of 500, that implies that national income is 500.
So you're making an inference as to what the wages are?
No. Up to now, I'm making an inference only as to national income, the sum of profits and wages together.
But
I haven't broken wages down separately.
Yeah, but the definition of national income is, in fact, profits plus wages.
Exactly. And we're in a position to know the sum of profits plus wages. We don't know wages separately, but we do know profits and wages taken together. If you subtract cost only on account of capital goods, that difference is profits and wages together. It's the value added. The value added is the sales minus the cost on account of capital goods. And the value added is profits and wages together. All right, now what I want to call to your attention is if we apply this same thing to what was previously figure 14.5, and now we have the same essentials, except we're bringing in the connection to sales revenues and cost on account of capital goods. Can anyone identify what national income is in this figure, figure 15.6?
$600.
Does anyone have a different answer besides 600 as national income? What are sales revenues? What's the cost on account of capital goods?
Sales revenues are 1,200.
Where do you get 1,200? Mr. Barton, what did you say?
I said 400. I was looking at consumers' goods.
Mr. Barton is saying that national income is 400. Does anyone agree with him?
Yeah.
Mr. Foster agrees. Why would you say national income? Mr. Winchell, what do you say?
I was agreeing.
Okay.
You have 1,000 minus the 600 and capital goods gives you the 400.
Yeah, the sales revenues are 1,000, right?
Yes.
Okay, what are costs on account of capital goods?
600.
So what's the sum of profits and wages together?
400.
400. 1,000 of sales minus costs of 600, where the costs are excluding the wages, it's simply cost on account of capital goods, that equals 400 to represent profits and wages together. So notice.
It's easier to understand it in an example where it's 600 and 400, because in the example where it's 500, every answer is 500.
Okay, that's true. But here, national income, if we view it as the difference between sales and cost on account of capital goods, it's 400, right? Now, in which of these two economies, if you had a choice, would you rather live? In this economy, with a national income of 400, but with production increasing at a rapid compound annual rate, and prices rapidly falling, so soon the 400 buys vastly more than the 500 used to buy. Which of these economies would it be preferable to for people to live in? In this one.
Such a difficult decision.
Pardon me?
You make it such a difficult decision.
Yeah. Well, there's a very significant implication here that there is a context, and this is the context, in which national income and economic progress and prosperity are inversely related. They're inversely related. It's better to have the national income of 400 than 500. And that's not accidental, that's necessary. Why? What is the foundation of the economic progress here? The higher demand for capital goods. The fact that the demand for capital goods is 600 now rather than 500. But the demand for capital goods does not count in national income. The demand for capital goods doesn't count in national income. National income is essentially the counterpart of consumption. And to have economic progress with the same quantity of money and volume of spending, we need less consumption and more demand for capital goods, which means the national income will be lower. Now, a derivation of this is an answer to what, for want of a better term, I think has to be called a shyster argument.
Shyster.
Yeah, there's shyster economics as well as shyster lawyers. You recall some discussion we had, I guess, last week of the Keynesian investment multiplier? Okay, now the Keynesians argue there are additional multipliers besides. There's a government spending multiplier, which has the same arithmetical value as the investment multiplier, for very similar reasons. And then there is supposed to be a negative tax multiplier. But this negative tax multiplier is a little bit smaller than the positive government spending multiplier. In fact, it's argued that it's smaller by one. Its absolute value is less by one. So if we had a marginal propensity to consume of 0.75 and a marginal propensity to save of 0.25, the government spending multiplier, it's held, would be 4, and the tax multiplier would be minus 3. Now, assuming these claims to be true, what would be the implied effect if we had, let us assume, a $10 billion increase in government spending and a $10 billion increase in taxes, both together? And if the two are occurring together, if we have an equal increase in government spending and in taxes, or equal decrease, it's argued there is implicitly present a new additional multiplier called the balanced budget multiplier. Can anyone make a stab at the value of this alleged balanced budget multiplier?
One.
Just think, if the government spending multiplier is 4, and we have $10 billion more government spending, how much national income should that produce?
40.
Plus 40. If the tax multiplier is minus 3, and we have $10 billion more taxes, how much national income does that wipe out?
30,
right? Three times 10. But what's the combined out of the combined effect of this equal increase in taxes and government spending? It's supposed to be plus 10. And you can actually find textbooks that think there's no limit to the miracles of government spending.
Is this still practiced?
I think this is still very widely believed. If you look through, get some recent textbook in the library. I'm sure it's still in Samuelson, called the Balanced Budget Multiplier. And its value is supposed to be 1. And the argument is, if the government raises our taxes, but is gracious enough to spend the proceeds, the effect will be an equivalent rise in national income. So what are all you rubes complaining about?
So
the taxes are really free. In taking our taxes away, the government gives us additional income out of which to pay the taxes. That's the argument here. Now, this analysis shows that you could have a case in which the government raises taxes, spends the money, and national income does rise. But this is not something to be happy about, because what is it implying about capital accumulation? It's negative, or at least less than it otherwise would be. A stationary economy instead of a progressing one, perhaps. Now, one of the things I hope to show, and this may not be till next week or even after that, is it is possible, suppose the government imposes a tax, and the tax falls on funds that would have been expended to buy capital goods. Let's say the government is collecting an extra $10 billion in taxes, and the taxes are paid with money that would have been used to buy machinery and materials. And the government spends the money in buying consumers' goods. All right, A, what is the effect on total economy-wide sales revenues?
Go down.
I'm hearing they go up, they go down. The overall result, even in the first year.
Pardon me?
It's the same.
Mr. Corman says they're the same. But why are the total sales revenues the same, Mr. Corman?
Well, instead of the money being spent on producing capital goods, it was spent on consumer goods.
Exactly. The demand for capital goods is down, but the demand for consumers' goods is up equivalently. So total aggregate sales revenues are the same. But now, if the demand for capital goods is down, what is going to be the effect a little bit later on the costs on account of capital goods?
Increase.
If less money is spent to buy capital goods, what is the effect on the amount of money deducted as a cost on account of capital goods? Pardon me?
Lower.
It should be less. It should be less. Now, I think I can understand why some of you say it would be higher. Unit costs might be higher. The cost of producing something per unit might be higher. But there'll be fewer units. The total expenditure for capital goods is less. If we have 500 spent for capital goods instead of 600, what will be the cost on account of capital goods? Only 500 instead of 600. So national income will be higher, and as a matter of fact, what we'll see when we get to it is the effect of such a thing is to raise the pre-tax amount of profits. The effect of a tax falling on capital goods would be to leave sales revenues in the economy unchanged, because the money will be spent to buy consumers' goods, but to reduce the cost on account of capital goods. And so taxes, profits pre-tax will tend to be higher. Profits after tax won't be any higher. The tax will be taken out of the higher pre-tax profits. So the national income might be unchanged. The after-tax profits might be unchanged. But what is happening to the rate of economic progress?
It's slowing down.
It's maybe stopped. So while it's true, there are circumstances in which this balanced budget multiplier might work as described, the error is the misinterpretation of the significance of such a rise in national income. All that's signified is that this is a context in which national income and economic progress and prosperity are inversely related. We should not take national income as a guide to economic progress and prosperity. And the same point would apply to GDP. Now you see, the Keynesians like this kind of example. They think they've discovered a conflict in the values of fiscal conservatives. They say fiscal conservatives have two major values. They want small government and balanced budgets. And these are two of their main fiscal values: small budgets and balanced budgets. Small government, balanced budgets. And now the Keynesians think if they bring in the multipliers, they can say, well, too bad, you fiscal conservatives. We're putting you in the position where you have to, in effect, choose between the equivalent of your mother and father. Either you can have balanced budgets or a deficit. Either you have a balanced budget with a much bigger government. You need a balanced budget with a much bigger government, or an unbalanced budget with a lesser size government. Now, how does that work? Well, here's the way they put it. Suppose that we simply increase government spending by 10, and the government spending multiplier is 4. How much will national income rise?
6.
4 times?
4 times what?
10,000, so
4 times the 10. Yeah. We're saying we increase government spending by 10. 10 could be 10 billion. If the multiplier is 4, then national income is supposed to increase by 4 times that, or 40, right? So they say, okay, if here we have more government spending without additional taxes, we have more government spending representing a deficit, then 10 billion of extra government spending results in 40 billion of extra national income. But if you don't want a deficit, if you jerks insist on a balanced budget, and we want to have a 40 billion increase in national income, then what are we going to have to do? We'll have to raise government spending and taxes both by 40. See, we'll have a balanced budget, but to get the same increase in national income, we have to have this much bigger increase in government spending and taxes. Of course, we'll have a lower multiplier. Well, the answer is national income and prosperity in this context are inversely related. So what happens to national income is not the standard, and what we really do want, after all, is small government with balanced budgets, even though that might mean a lower nominal national income. It might mean we have a 400 national income instead of a 500 national income. But that's what's required for economic progress and prosperity. Yes, Mr. Boisseau.
Did I read that Ronald Reagan was like a disciple of the Keynesian philosophy, or?
No, he favored an alternative approach, not a full alternative, but a significant alternative, known as, quote, supply-side economics.
Who would be, in modern history, who would represent the Keynesian?
Pardon me?
Who would represent the, am I saying it right, Keynesian?
Yeah, the Keynesian view, yeah.
In modern history, what? Politician okay. Theater would represent the Keynesian.
The entire New Deal and Truman and probably at least through Johnson.
Increased government spending.
Yeah, greater government spending. And I'm sure there's still a substantial contingent that would favor the same policies. Okay, now we're in a position to finally get beyond chapter 15 And let's turn to a further supplement. And this next subject will build upon what we've been doing. What we're turning to now is a discussion of aggregate profit and the average rate of profit in the economic system. The total economy-wide amount of profit and the average rate of profit in the economic system. Understanding profit as sales minus costs, and continuing as we have been to take profits gross of interest cost, pre-deduction of interest cost. And I introduced the subject with this opening paragraph. All business activity is carried on for the purpose of earning a profit. And there are major questions in connection with this, such as, are the profits earned in the economic system at the expense of the wage earners, which is the doctrine of Marx? Marx held that profits are earned by the underpayment of the wage earners, that they are based on the exploitation of labor. And from that perspective, all profits are automatically too high, because they all represent exploitation. Then there's an opposite critique of profits, which comes from Keynes, which is, interestingly, the claim that profits are too low, and they tend to be too low to make it worthwhile to invest, with the result that people end up hoarding all the funds they should have invested. So we'll be dealing with both of these perspectives, and I think I can show the rate of profit is neither too high nor too low. It's determined by intelligible forces. It's not made at the expense of the wage earners, and it is also high enough to make it worthwhile to invest. And related issues, do technological progress and improvements in business efficiency raise the average rate of profit? This is something that's very widely believed. If you just think back a few years in the stock market boom, what argument was advanced over and over again to justify the very high levels of stock prices?
Technology.
Yeah, technological advance. We have the internet generation or whatever, and the argument was, now we have the internet, this is making everything much more profitable, so that justifies the high stock prices. And that argument repeats itself every generation or two. In the 1920s, the argument was, well, now we have a radio, and we have electric refrigerators, and there's no limit to this prosperity, brand new, wonderful technology. And it was wonderful technology. But the assumption was that if we have technological advance, that means we have a rise in the rate of profit. That was the assumption, that if we have broad-based, economy-wide technological advance, or at least pervasive technological advance, that implies a rise in the economy-wide average rate of profit. And going back maybe 100 years or a little more, you had the same thing. Well, we have electrification, or we're building the railroads. There's always something new, and it's used as justification for what's going on in a boom, which really has no relation. Now, what's further interesting is that again and again, and I think for the most part, the very same people who think that technological progress raises the rate of profit, they also, at a different point in their thinking, imply that it lowers the rate of profit. Now, how does that happen? Well, what's the effect of technological progress on the supply of goods produced?
It creates more.
What's the effect of a larger supply of goods produced on prices?
Lower.
It lowers prices. But what's a synonym for lower prices or falling prices?
Greater consumption.
Well, a synonym, a word used to describe the phenomenon of falling, yes?
Deflation.
Deflation, deflation. But, and what is the implication of deflation for business profits?
It's fall.
It's radically reduced, wiped out. It means depression. So notice this. They have the same people thinking, they're looking at technological progress at one aspect, and they're thinking, boy, this is really good for profits. It's all kinds of wonderful new investment opportunities. But then, at another point in their thinking, which they don't relate back to this part, they think, what about the increase in the supply of goods that's resulting from this technological progress? That's lowering prices, that's deflation, that's terrible for profits. So there's this contradiction. One and the same cause, technological progress, is held both to raise and lower the rate of profit. This is nonsense on the face of it. We'll look at this in detail as we get into the material. Then there's another question that I think we've actually looked at fairly well, and that's this question, do saving and capital accumulation imply a falling rate of profit? I think we'll probably we'll need to look at this a little further.
On the surface it does.
Pardon me?
On the surface it would, right?
Well, you say on the surface. I'll postpone attempting to answer that. And closely related, I think this aspect is perhaps what we've looked at. Well, I'm not sure. Does additional saving place business in the contradictory position of having more money available to invest at the very time its sales revenues are reduced because the consumers are saving instead of spending? This is something that's widely believed. It's thought the source of business sales is the consumer's expenditure. If the consumers consume less, there's less sales revenues. If they're saving more, we need to invest the additional funds they're saving. How can we do this profitably in the face of declining sales revenues? This even has a name. It's been called the paradox of saving. Now, I don't know if you're aware of it, but we've really already answered this and the other questions in the analysis we've worked out on the board, on the screen. And of course, then there's this final question, can there be such a thing as too much of an increase in production or too much saving? And it's all of these questions that I promise to answer, if not tonight, then in the coming weeks. Okay, here we are. We're turning to an analysis of aggregate profit. And let me jump right in to the nature and problem of aggregate profit. I've said enough, I think, about the treatment of interest. Let me elaborate on point B, profits at the macro level determined by different factors than at the micro level. Let me elaborate on that. The micro level refers to, above all, the individual company. Now, when people think, for example, that technological progress raises the rate of profit, they're looking exclusively at the effect of technological progress on the profitability of individual companies. If any individual company has a technological advance that its competitors do not have and that the market approves of, that's going to be extremely good for the profits of that company. And it's simply on that basis that people assume that if all companies have technological advances, the profits of all of them will be good. But if you think about this a little more carefully, if you think along the lines recommended by Hazlitt, namely looking at the effects of things on all of the relevant parties, not just those most directly concerned, and looking long run as well as short, well, let's suppose we have some technological advance. Think in the automobile industry, there was a time when the self-starter was introduced. Now, if you're the only firm whose cars have a self-starter, what's the effect on your profits? It'll be very, very positive. But what's the effect on the profitability of those auto firms that don't have a self-starter yet? their profits go down because your profits are going up because you're taking business away from them. So the self-starter is very good for your profits, but at the same time, it's negative for your competitors who don't have it. Now, you might consider, okay, let's suppose the whole industry has the self-starter and various other improvements. Maybe it might be that could even be good for the whole industry. Because automobiles are now more convenient, more people will buy them, and so maybe the sales revenues and profits of the entire auto industry go up. But then you have to ask, where are people getting the money to spend more in buying automobiles? Would they have been doing anything else with that money? Now, if we had an economy with the same quantity of money and the same overall total volume of spending, and now people are spending more in buying the products of a certain industry, what's implied about the spending on the products of other industries? That goes down, and their profits go down. So does this technological improvement, which raises the profits of a given firm and possibly even a whole industry, does that imply anything about the profitability of the whole economy?
No.
No, not at all. Pardon me?
It's a wash.
It's a wash. And that's what you can see if you go back and think in terms of the diagrams we looked at, figures 14, 4, and 5, 15, 5, and 6. And we'll have more elaborate diagrams bringing out profit. At the macroeconomic level, technological progress is neutral with regard to the rate of profit. It's very positive for those who are in the forefront of introducing new technologies, who gain a competitive advantage by it, but it does nothing for the economy-wide aggregate amount or average rate of profit. There is one limited significant exception, and that is if we had a commodity money, such as gold or silver, technological progress in the production of the monetary unit in enabling us to produce a larger quantity of gold or silver, that could be positive for the rate of profit. But that's not because of technological progress per se. It's because we have a factor that is increasing the quantity of money. And one of the things we'll develop is that the economy-wide average rate of profit does depend in part on the rate of increase in the quantity of money. The pure dollar amount and dollar rate of profit does depend in part on the rate of increase in the quantity of money. If we had a commodity money, technological progress in the production of that commodity would be positive for the economy-wide average rate of profit by virtue of adding more money. But technological progress in the production of television sets, shoes, computers, whatever, that is neutral with regard to the overall economy-wide average rate of profit. And as we'll see, you'll be able to see this virtually before your eyes when we elaborate those diagrams to show profits. Now, in this connection, profits at the macro level determined by different factors than at the micro level. At the micro level, a very vital element determining the profits of an individual company is its competitive situation. A firm that has a competitive advantage will be a profitable firm, an exceptionally profitable firm. But at the same time, those over whom it has that advantage, they are correspondingly less profitable. So you can't generalize from what affects the profits of an individual company to the entire system. Wherever you have competition, you can't look at the winner of the competition and generalize to the loser, or at the loser and generalize to the winner. You have to be very careful of that. Now, the significance of a rate of profit at the macro level and micro level can be very different because of this. If we see an individual company with a very high rate of profit, let's say a 30, 40% rate of profit, that's pretty huge. If it's earning that because it's in the forefront of innovation, well, the implication is very positive for the economy, for the real interests of everybody, It means we have more and better goods entering the economy. Our methods of production are more efficient. This is fundamentally very, very positive. It's a part of economic progress. But if you have a situation where the average economy-wide rate of profit would be 30 or 40%, that would be horrendous. That would not be the result of more rapid technological progress. More rapid technological progress won't produce that. What sort of thing would produce an economy-wide average rate of profit of 30 or 40%?
That's more consumption, more money.
If we had rapid inflation, if we had rapid inflation of the money supply, so that whatever you spend this year, whatever products you produce by spending money this year, next year, there'll be 40% more money available to buy those products. That would operate to add 40% to profits. But is that a situation of progress and improvement? What kind of rate of profit do they have, or have had, I don't know, the current rates of inflation in Latin America. I believe they're down substantially from where they used to be. But I believe they're still quite high compared to us. What kind of average rate of profit do they have in places like Brazil and Argentina, and average rates of interest? Does anyone know?
Profit or interest?
Well, both. Start with, pick either.
Interest I've heard as much as 25-30%.
Where would that be?
Where?
Yeah.
In Mexico?
Mexico. They say they have a 25-30% rate of interest. Well, if they have that for any length of time, if business firms are paying a 25 or 30% rate of interest, what would motivate them to do so? They have to have a commensurate rate of profit.
Right.
They need a rate of profit perhaps even a little bit higher. Now, you might have the rate of interest temporarily higher than the rate of profit if firms are borrowing to stave off insolvency. But as a longer run proposition, the rate of profit and the rate of interest go together. And what would result in such high rates of profit and interest? There has to be a rapidly flowing monetary spigot. See, just think, business firms spend money at one point in time to produce products which they're going to sell at a later point and be paid for at a later point in time. Well, the more rapidly the quantity of money and volume of spending are increasing over this interval of time, what is implied about the sales revenues that the business firms will be able to take in later on compared with what they otherwise would have taken in? They'll be greater. Now, their outlays in the past, they're not retroactively changed. They're still what they were. So the increase in money and spending is systematically widening the margin between sales revenues and costs. That's how it's elevating the rate of profit. So this is not a good development if this is going on to any great degree. Yet at the macroeconomic level, this is the kind of thing, this is one of the things that would be required to raise the economy-wide average rate of profit, an inflation of the money supply. Now, you could have a higher economy-wide amount and rate of profit without any inflation at all, without any increase in the quantity of money at all. And that would be if we had more consumption and less productive expenditure. Costs come from productive expenditure. If productive expenditure is less, costs in the economy are going to be less. But sales revenues can be the same. We'll have more profit. This we'll go into and elaborate a little later on, or next week, I guess. So either way, whether it's through more money and spending or through less saving and productive expenditure, the economy-wide aggregate amount and average rate of profit can easily have an inverse relationship to economic progress and prosperity.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yeah. The economy-wide aggregate amount and average rate of profit can easily have an inverse relationship to economic progress and prosperity. I don't want to make that as a universal statement, but in frequent situations, that will be true. Where high rates of profit are the result of rapid inflation, there's a negative relationship between the rate of profit and progress and prosperity. And where you would have a high rate of profit as the result of low saving and productive expenditure and high consumption, you have the same negative relationship. And I think you can see this at least roughly through observation. Where would you expect the rate of profit and interest to be higher, in the United States or in Afghanistan? I would think in Afghanistan. But is that a prosperous country? Quite the contrary. Adam Smith observed over 200 years ago, and he was right in this, I think, that in those countries where the rate of profit and interest is highest, they tend to be the countries going most rapidly to ruin. And it's based, the element of truth in it is based on the implications as to the low degree of saving and productive expenditure. Now, this is very, very different than high profits for various individual firms, which are made by their competitive contribution. It's one thing for certain firms to be earning 30, 40, 50%, while their less fortunate competitors are losing money or earning the most minimal profits, and practically everybody making significant profits. It's great for the innovators to make high profits, while those who are not innovating, who are stagnating, to be taking losses. But it would be very bad if any jerk can make a high rate of profit. Then you have an economy that's in trouble. All right, let me turn to point D. I'll skip over C here. The problem of aggregate profit. Well, I'll tell you what, I don't think that this discussion is going to stick too well. I'll have to repeat it next week. Okay, so why don't we take we'll leave a few minutes early. Is that okay with anybody, with everybody? No, there are people who bother. Protest. Okay. All right, it's only 10 minutes. So, okay. Have a great week.
That bothers you, we're leaving. Yeah, now I gotta get started early.
Are you really gonna do this today?
I'm gonna.